right. Well, good evening, everyone. We are so glad you are here tonight. Of course, most of you know this. It's on. Most of you know this, but I am Libby Grammer. I am one of the ministers here at River Road Church, and I have just written a book, which is why you're all here. My book, Privilege, Risk, and Solidarity, just came out, and I would like to just take a few minutes before we do the book signing to talk a little bit about the background of where this book came from, as well as exploring a little bit of what's in the book. So this is my first book, and it is a culmination of about 8 years of writing. I studied ethics in seminary at McAfee School of Theology at Mercer down in Georgia, and then I moved to Virginia, to Charlottesville, and studied at UVA, and I continued studying Christian ethics there. There I focused in Christian feminist ethics, and that is where this book is coming from. It's coming from those two experiences. Additionally, it's coming from the experience that I have working in a law firm. For 10 years, in May, I will have been at Baker Donaldson Law Firm working as an immigration paralegal. I worked with Robert Devine, who is used to be the chief counsel and acting director of USCIS. So for 10 years, I have worked with somebody who knows the ins and outs of immigration, and I have learned quite a bit from him about the law, how it should work, how it does work, how it doesn't work. And so I've been deeply fortunate to have the dual experience of both working in ethics and Christianity and working in the law. So I care a great deal about the moral implications of this issue and the legal implications. So you might be curious as to why I chose Christian feminist ethics to study undocumented immigration. Where did this come from? During my time at the University of Virginia, I was deeply drawn to the work of Christian feminist ethics because I thought that so often ethical methodologies, the things that we were trying to create frameworks about moral issues, often didn't ask questions of the people involved. So here's an issue, and we failed to ask the people who are hurting under this issue or conflicted about this issue about how they feel. And feminist ethics, especially in its manifestations in Black feminist liberationist theology, Mujerista theology, so that's Latina theology, and womanist theology, which is from the Black church, from feminists there. And the work of these feminists stops to listen to the stories of those most affected by moral issues. And it also asks hard questions of those of us who are privileged. And often those were the same people in the ivory tower writing the methodologies. So I loved how feminist ethics asked the question and asked the question direct. So I took this use of listening, this use of storytelling, along with solid ethical frameworks to serve as a host to a lot of different issues. And in this case, undocumented immigration. These issues can range from gender issues to xenophobia to racism. And I think that feminist ethics has a wealth of resources to respond to ethical issues, especially humanitarian issues like undocumented immigration. When we speak about the realities of people of color, and especially those with no legal status, we speak of a precarious way of fearful living every day. For some of us, we have never faced such a way of living. We are those whom we call privileged. Even if in some ways we may yet be marginalized, those of us with U.S. citizenship or those of us with white skin have profound advantages over minority races and the undocumented. We don't face discrimination on the basis of something that we cannot control or change, our skin color, our birth country, or in the case of our immigration laws, our immigration status. Thus, we need to realize that by not speaking out on behalf of those with no voice and not listening to their stories and walking alongside them in solidarity, we are in fact part of the problem. We are part of an unjust system. And when I say that, I mean to say, we all are. We all are in some way, whether we mean to be or not. But being an oppressor in an oppressive system does not define me or anyone else as inherently evil, but it does bring with it an opportunity and a responsibility to take risk and act in solidarity with those who have no voice. To me, the idea that I might be an oppressor by the very nature of benefiting from a broken system doesn't mean that I need to despair. But instead, it leads me to seek to extend the kind of radical love that Jesus extended to me. I must sacrifice my own privilege and my own status to give space to those with none. As you know, this is a very timely political issue. And this is a reason to ask, what does this all mean in our political situation now? I think now more than ever, we cannot pretend that these 11 million people do not exist. We must choose a direction in which we want the country to move. We have an administration right now tightening borders, working to remove undocumented immigrants at an alarming pace. And along with a long-term, decades-long-term deadlock in Congress on the issue, we face an expansive and an urgent humanitarian issue. Currently, undocumented immigrants are being deported, whether they are otherwise criminals or just moms and dads of U.S. citizens. Or perhaps they were undocumented children brought here without their knowledge many years ago. Or families who have been here for decades and they don't know any other home other than the violence that they fled many years ago. Those of us with political voice, and especially leaders and participants in faith communities, we must become advocates. And that begins, I think, with understanding the issue in deeper detail and thinking through the moral implications of our own beliefs and our own actions about this issue. Who will we be as Christians among the strangers in our land? And why? How can we become faithful caregivers and love providers to those most marginalized by a broken system of laws? I don't believe reading this book is going to give you every answer. But I do believe reading this book is one step of many in a journey to care and compassion, and that more than anything, what I would love for this book to do is start a conversation. Most hopefully, a conversation with your immigrant neighbor. The book begins giving readers a chance to better understand immigration law and history. I wanted to provide some insights into why I believe that our immigration laws, while fundamentally part of sovereign nations' laws, are broken. They're broken to the point that they no longer serve to extend hospitality, nor do they work to unite families. I say in the book that Christians must accept that a government has a set of rules and seek to follow those rules. However, Christians must also measure those rules against their faith and convictions. When laws are unjust and do not conform to the gospel, Christians have the responsibility to address them from a faith-based perspective. This book calls on Christians to understand where unjust systems of laws can alienate people. It calls on those of us with privilege to listen to their stories and give space for their voices to be heard. And it ultimately calls us to then take risk and to be in solidarity with those with whom we've learned and grown in this process of listening. I then spend two chapters telling stories. In the first of these chapters, I examine the importance of story for Christians. I began with a biblical study of relevant passages about immigrants in the Old and New Testament. And then I take some time to talk about how Black feminist liberationist and Mujerista theology outlines the use of stories. And then I give stories of real-life immigrants, people I've met, people I have met through others. I end the book with some explanation of systemic injustice, including a frank look at what it means to have white U.S. citizen privilege and what it means to be marginalized. And lastly, I give ways in which feminist theology can aid in comprehensive Christian responses to this issue, including a thorough understanding of the need to see and listen, the need for responsibility and autonomy of the marginalized, and the importance of risk-taking and solidarity. So in relation to the power of stories for feminist ethics, I would like to share a short excerpt from the book. Working in the fields of immigration law and ministry, I've had the profound opportunity to meet, work with, and learn from immigrants with stories. While much of my professional work in immigration law has been focused on corporate law, the cases that touch my heart most deeply have been those that are family-based and dealing with undocumented immigrants and their families, doing everything possible to stay in the U.S. legally. These cases come with profound, powerful stories that challenge me to reevaluate my assumptions and intersect with my desire to love my neighbor. These cases reveal also my ever-growing understanding of the shortcomings of our current immigration legal system and confront me with the harder questions of immigration law. No longer are the concepts of the law simply theoretical. They're not a theoretical problem. They have a face, they have a life, and they have a family. And similarly, as a minister, I have become acutely aware of people's needs in ways I never imagined. I have been given opportunities to serve with those on the front lines of the immigration debate as they encounter lo cotidiano, or the everyday. The everyday lives of those caught up in a system beyond their grasp. And so let us hear together a couple of these stories. Early in my career in immigration law, I worked on a pro bono case involving Cecilia, a young undocumented Mexican mother of two boys who had been sponsored for permanent residence by her husband, who was also a permanent resident. Because the process of sponsorship can take years for Mexican nationals married to permanent residents, Cecilia had been left without immigration recourse when her husband abused her. In fact, during the repeated abuse, her husband had called into question Cecilia's own morality, which is one of the discretionary ways permanent residence can be denied. He had called the police on her when she defended herself, falsely reporting her as the abuser to the police. None of this was her fault. It was his substance abuse, his threats of violence with a gun, his beating of his own elder son, and yet there stood Cecilia, straddling the fence of finally being free of her husband through divorce and holding very little hope of finally gaining legal status once the divorce was finalized. Her two boys, both born in the United States, and thus both U.S. citizens, would continue to run the risk of having their mother pulled away from them and deported. Cecilia stood in our office, having reached out through a nonprofit agency, with a pending divorce, almost no money, and now a husband who had made good on his threat to pull away her immigration status when she was most vulnerable. The standing in line, as we like to call it, for immigration benefits for Cecilia was not so simple. It would mean staying with her abuser, keeping her boys near someone who threatened her life and her health. But thankfully, at least for that term, Congress had reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA, which allows abused spouses to petition the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services for residence after demonstrating, I might add, with copious amounts of paper and a definite need for a legal team, that he or she qualifies based on the history of abuse, and that he or she has good moral character, which can be hard to overcome with abusers routinely lying about their spouses. But because of these countless pro bono hours, Cecilia's impassioned statement and the statements of her struggling boys, the statements of witnesses, along with just enough evidence to convince a USCIS officer, Cecilia was finally free of her abuser. No longer required to have him as a sponsor, she could remain in the US to care for her two boys on her own terms. Her story is one of the happy endings, leading to the eventual arrest of her ex-husband, with his admission of guilt of abusing his spouse in open court. Hers is a story of courage in the face of fear, and persistence when all hope seemed lost. I was grateful then, and for cases since, where legal avenues like VAWA do exist. But it left me wondering then, and now, what if Cecilia had simply had options to enter legally to begin with? What if she had already been working here legally and able to support her children alone? What if laws designed to prevent illegal entry had not backfired and made her remain here for fear of being barred of entry for 10 years? Why is it so easy to be sponsored by an abuser and so hard to get away from it? Why are there no more options for Cecilia and her boys? And why, just a few years later, did it take Congress so long to reauthorize such a basic protective law as VAWA? In another way, a young couple, Pablo and Susanna, had married in rural Tennessee, a small Baptist church. Their friends and family were excited for their future. Pablo was a strong worker and labored as a bricklayer for many years. And then he felt the call of God on his life to ministry. The pair were inseparable, and just a year into their marriage, they welcomed a sweet little girl, Lily, into their family. But behind all of their outward joy, there was a lingering knowledge that Pablo, who had arrived in the United States as a teenager many years ago and had crossed the border more than once, would not be eligible to become a permanent resident just because he had married Susanna, a U.S. citizen. Unlike cases where an immigrant has only entered the U.S. one time and accrued some unlawful presence, which is forgivable when you marry a U.S. citizen, Pablo would have had to leave the United States and process for an immigrant visa at the U.S. consulate in Juarez, Mexico. He would wait for months, even years, in one of the most violent cities in the world. His case would not have been approved immediately, as he would have to provide evidence of extreme hardship to his U.S. citizen family members if he were not allowed to become a resident, a requirement that, I might add, is very hard to meet. This young family, their pastor, and Susanna's parents all sat around our boardroom table explaining how wonderful Pablo had been in the community and the church, and all fearful about what to do next. They did not want Pablo to keep having to hide, but exposing him to the legal immigration process could have him deported or stuck in Mexico for up to 10 years or more. For months, our immigration team worked with the family and their friends to gather evidence of this hardship. Honest and conservative rural Tennesseans wrote letters explaining their unease about supporting someone who supposedly broke the law. But knowing Pablo, they felt compelled to try to help. This immigrant, he was different. We know him. He's good people. It's amazing how stories and the intersection of lives are strong motivators for change. With so many support letters and evidence of depression and anxiety for his wife, we sent Pablo to the consulate armed with all he could muster. The consulate took his papers and sent him away. He waited weeks and weeks, working odd jobs at English-speaking resorts outside Juarez. And when the consulate issued a notice stating that the evidence was not enough, the family once again jumped into action, preparing everything they could. Susanna even personally flew to Mexico to submit it with Pablo. They wouldn't even let her in. They waited. Months passed. The family was constantly in tears and worried. Susanna could not remain in Mexico, fearful for her child's safety, and Pablo would not have it anyway. He couldn't ask them to stay there. Susanna returned to the United States with Lily and sat anxiously awaiting news, spending countless hours crying with her parents and on the phone with her husband, who seemed a world away. After over a year of waiting, the case was finally approved. Pablo could re-enter the U.S. and rejoin his family and his community. But so few of these hardship cases are ever approved, and most families don't want to risk the separation. There are laws now coming into play that could help with that, but most of them are in injunctions with the court. This order that has been put in place has been fought fiercely by those who would seek to slow or even end immigration. but with its regulations on hold and unavailable to families like Pablo's until courts make decisions, it could still be years away for so many families. And so, while I know that this one book cannot ever encapsulate a complete response to this extremely complex and unwieldy issue that's political, that's moral, that has a lot of different faces, I do hope that this book starts conversations. Conversations about undocumented immigration as an issue and about people, people whom we need to know, people who are hurt by these laws. I also hope that as Christians and people of faith, we extend the kind of care and hospitality that our scripture requires of us, even as we take further steps to advocate and be in solidarity in political ways. I also hope that faith groups, churches, and others begin to explore these different ways of being in solidarity. Start befriending those in our midst who are undocumented or refugees. Just here in Richmond's West End, we have a large immigrant population. And befriending these neighbors begins with just small steps by those of us with privilege. Perhaps in your context, that might look like volunteering at Crossover Healthcare Ministries, where they serve hundreds of uninsured immigrants each week. Perhaps it means getting involved in the lives of undocumented children or children of undocumented parents by volunteering at the local elementary school in a reading or ESL program. Perhaps it's advocating politically or providing sanctuary for undocumented immigrants. Perhaps it's serving alongside those already in the hard work of assisting immigrants, such as Lucha Ministries, whose founder is here with us this evening, Sue Smith. Whatever you are able to do, my prayer is that we no longer sit on the sidelines of this major issue, but that we actively listen and engage our immigrant neighbors and work for their rights in this nation that we love. Thank you.